Welcome, everyone, to the first in a series of public events that Silvia Federici is giving in the UK, coinciding with the release of her new book, Revolution at Point Zero. It gives me great pleasure to introduce Silvia Federici, who is not only an outstanding feminist scholar and activist, but also an inspiring comrade and friend. In 1972, she was the co-founder of the International Feminist Collective, which launched the Wages for Housework, which launched Wages for Housework campaign. Alongside other members of the Wages for Housework, including Maria Rosa della Costa and feminist scholars like Maria Mies and Vandana Shiva, Silvia has been instrumental in developing the concept of reproduction as a key to understanding class relations of exploitation and domination in local and global contexts. At the same time, it is also a concept that is central to forms of resistance, autonomy, and the commons. Which, as many of us who have been active in feminist movements, in Occupy, in recent student movements, and in struggles against austerity can testify, the terrain of social reproduction has once again become central not only to our thinking and our analysis, but also our desires to make plans and to create new forms of organisation. Silvia is also the author of Caliban and the Witch, Women, the Body and Primitive Accumulation, which is one of those books that will change the way that you think. It's not only about gender, but also the development of capitalism and history. It is, without exaggeration, a must-read and read again for anyone who is interested in radical social change. Tonight, Silvia is presenting a lecture entitled From Commoning to Debt, Microcredit Student Debt and the Disinvestment in Reproduction. Please make her feel welcome. Thank you.
Thank you for this long reception, and thank you to Camille and to the Center for Cultural Studies for inviting me here. What I'm going to present tonight is a series of reflections on an issue which is, I think, of great importance to our world and truly internationally, which is the increasing use of debt by capitalism, the state, as a means not only of social control, but also of accumulation of wealth. And what I want to do tonight is to look at what are the political implications of the fact that debt is becoming more and more an important element in the relation between labor and capital, and in the organization of our everyday life. And above all, what are the lessons that we can draw from this over-present hegemony of debt in our life for the struggles that we need to construct? And I want to add that the centrality of debt in the present political economy, of course, has been, in my own experience, in my own life, brought to the foreground by my involvement in the anti-globalization movement, when for many years I was involved with other people in the struggle against the debt crisis in Africa in particular, and against the program of structural adjustment, especially as they were applied to the adjustment of educational system in Africa. And in more recent time, the question of debt has also come to the foreground in a very strong way in the process of the building of a student movement against debt in the United States, which is in fact growing and expanding to include many other forms of debt, struggle around not only the refusal of the payment of student loan, but to include also struggle relating to mortgage, foreclosures, credit cards, so that in fact debt is becoming increasingly a common ground in which all kinds of struggles are beginning to meet. And the question, of course, for us is You know, what in the course of this struggle we have to decide. You know, what kind of strategy we use so that the outcome is not something that reignites the condition that produced the death to begin with, but something that can take us beyond the society where death is continuously created. And before I go more in detail, I want to tell you about, since particularly we are in a university, about this beautiful little book that this organization in New York called Strike Death has produced, which is very, very good, very useful. And you can actually download it if you go to www.strikedeathoneworld.org. And it's the Death Resistors Operators Manual, which Strike Death is a new organization, mostly of students, but not exclusively by any means. But it's an organization that takes a particular position on the question of student loans, which is that the student loans should not be paid because they were never legitimate to begin with, since education should not be something that is bought and sold. Education should not be a commodity, and therefore the repayment of the loan should not be done because the loan was not again legitimate to begin with, which is very different from other students' organizations, which for example are fighting against the debt from a consumer viewpoint, which claim, for instance, that students should have the right to go bankrupt if they cannot pay the debt, in the same ways as other debtors, you know, have access to their right. Okay, so I'm going to leave this aside and try to see what is the question of debt to begin with. I mean, being here in Goldsmith, where David Graeber teaches, I imagine that you're all familiar with that the first 5,000 years. And as you know, as David has shown to us, there is a long history. That has had a long, long history in the class struggle. You know, in ancient Greece, you know, 7th century BC, you had debt revolts leading to debt cancellations and all kinds of prohibitions when those struggles were victorious, you know, against indebtment. You also had struggles in ancient Rome. In more recent time, as making a big, big leap in time, we have seen how debt was used by the corporate capital and the international state, by which I refer to the IMF, the World Bank, WTO, how it was used to bring about a regime of actual recolonization in many parts of the third world, Africa, Latin America, parts of Asia. And by recolonization, I mean the use of debt, of state debt, you know, and the debt crisis to institute basically reforms that have liberalized those economies and have actually destroyed those local economies, making them open to foreign investment and opening open to imports that have practically dismantled local production. And so we have seen the impact and the power of the indebtedness of the state, which has in fact resulted in a massive condition of pauperization. Because in addition to the removal of protection on global economy, that has been used to impose austerity regime, which have really devastated, as you all know, the public sector, health, education, transport services, and all the services taken to the basic necessities of life. Now, at the same time, what we have seen in the course of the last 20 years, it's also been a new development in the use of debt. There's been a, debt has been used in a new way, that in the sense that there has been a kind of debt that has been, that is targeted, not just the state, as in the case of structural adjustment, but has targeted directly individual and communities. And I refer here in particular to the vast process that we often refer to as the financialization of reproduction. And what I mean by the financialization of reproduction is the fact that more and more we are witness a double process whereby on one side we have had a massive disinvestment of the state in the reproduction of the workforce, which is often referred to as the welfare state. I have to tell you, I don't like the word welfare state. I never liked it. I think it's a very, very mystifying concept. It puts a kind of benign, benevolent face on the state, whereas I think it's much more appropriate to speak of the state that took as its strategy, right, the investment in certain aspects of working class reproduction, you know, which was the regime that prevailed in the 60s and part of the 70s. And it was an investment that was calculated, in fact, to produce higher levels of productivity. They were supposed to make workers more productive, so they invest, for example, in education, because the idea is that that money will be repaid years from now with more productive and more obedient citizens. Or you invest in certain type of social services because, again, there was the idea that this was human capital investment. That basically it was worthy, it was necessary, because it would pay down the line in the creation of a more less conflictual and more productive society. Well, the struggles of the end of the 60s and early 70s clearly put this project into crisis. I think if we just even look at the response of the state to the student movement, for example, the response of the state in our case in the United States, right, to the women's movement and the relationship that the women's movement to the struggle of women on welfare, soul-supported mothers, right, they had been receiving a certain amount of money on the argument that that work they were doing, raising a child, was in fact work. That looking at the response of the state, is very clear that the state realized or came to the conclusion that those investments did not pay. That those investments actually produced a higher conflictuality in the sense of giving more space time and more resources to the beneficiaries for actually organizing themselves and actually creating, building forms of resistance to the state of power and to capitalist power. So what we see happening in the course of the 70s, and certainly this comes to a climax in the 80s and 90s, I mean, it's really one of the pillars of the neoliberal agenda. What we see happening, we see in fact an inversion, which is really being one of the most important social transformations that we are witnessing. That certainly I witnessed in the last 20, 25 years. The inversion whereby, whereas in the 60s, the state invested in some significant aspect of our reproduction. In the course of two decades, that investment is withdrawn, then the investment is cut, And now we are being asked to invest in our own reproduction. In other words, reproduction investment is now being thrown back, onto our shoulders, and this has become the basis, this has been the ground, the material ground for the process that I refer to as the financialization of our reproduction. You know, the word financialization has a whole aura of mystery about it. You know, people associated with this funny business world up there, and there's been all this debate, is financialization, financial capital real or non-real? And it's always associated with the idea of this financier speculating on our future. But financialization is actually a very real process, very real part of our economic life. And you can see that when you look at the way financialization has actually entered our everyday reproduction and has become a way of organizing our work on a day-to-day basis. And what I mean by that specifically, and I will look at how this occurs in different scenarios, in different places. But the example I was making before of the student loan is a very classic example. So there were ads, in the 60s, you had a struggle for wages for schoolwork, and you have a state providing subsidies to encourage, a more educated, the production of a more educated workforce. You know, by the late 70s, certainly in the United States, those subsidies are withdrawn, and in the place of subsidy, we have the market, the bank, the loan. And we have a whole generation of students of year after year has been sinking more and more deeply into that, right, under the guise of providing for their future in a context in which we are continuously reminded that if you don't have education, your life will be nothing. You will be condemned to sweep the street or have the most unsatisfactory jobs. And therefore, that education is a must because we live in a knowledge-based society, and consequently, we have to have a certificate, and that certificate we have to pay for. This is a very simple example of the financialization of our reproduction. But of course, it's not the only example. There are many, many others that we're all familiar with. For example, the use of credit cards, to the extent that by the 80s, jobs were becoming more and more precarious, that welfare benefits were cut to a great extent, and always in an accelerating fashion. Increasingly, a number of households have been forced to rely on credit card as a way of reproducing themselves. And in fact, the overall household debt, and here my figures unfortunately come mostly from the United States. I know that, for example, the total household debt has reached in recent time really astronomical proportion, like $12 trillion, which compare, for instance, corporate debt is now, I think, stands about $24 trillion, and government debt about $8 trillion. So behind those astronomical figures, there is a population, and here there'll be, if I had more time, or maybe if we were involved in a collective project, I would encourage actually some of you to really do, that would be a really nice project. Because clearly, financialization too has not been an uncontested terrain, right? Clearly, to the extent that by the 80s, hundreds of thousands of people found their benefit cards, found it more and more difficult to have access to wage employment, right? The use of the credit card became also a means of struggle. Right? It was not only forced down their throat, but it also became a means of struggle. It would be really interesting to study to that terrain To what extent financialization was also to some extent used and promoted by a whole population of workers, of communities, who were now finding themselves slipping away, losing whatever they had gained in the struggle because of the impact of the new policies that neoliberalism ushered in. Now, over the years, you begin to see not only the growth of debt, which clearly is well exemplified by the student loans debt, the growth of debt by people using credit cards, but you also begin to see that something happens together with that development. You begin to see that this phenomenon is not only a purely economic phenomenon. In other words, there's an economic element, which is that, unlike in the past, you know, under the regime of the so-called welfare state, where the state was expected to invest in our reproduction, we now have a situation where reproduction is seen as to be a responsibility of the working class. And every moment of our life, every moment of our reproduction becomes a potential means of accumulation, becomes a potential moment of accumulation. In other words, if you want to think in terms of a capitalist strategy, you have a capitalism that basically does not want to wait any longer for the future to cash in on the investment, because they don't believe that investment will be productive in the future, and therefore wants instead to turn our accumulation, our reproduction, every moment of it, immediately into a moment of creation of wealth. So we use the credit card and they take a good cut of it through a continuous raise of the interest rate. We get the loan, and of course the loans, interest on the loans have been continuously escalated, etc., etc., etc. And so we begin to see something developing, which is we begin to see that when we speak of financialization of reproduction, and when we see its most obvious outcome, which is this incredible growth of indebtedness, this whole population that in one way or the other is in debt now to the banks, we begin to see actually that there is a new type of weapon, is a new type of instrument that is beginning to come into the social scene that is changing the relationship, what in classical Marxist terms you call the relation between labor and capital. In other words, that through the debt and the mechanism of indebtedness, you don't have only the transformation of every moment of reproduction into a means of accumulation, but you also have a new form of class relation that comes into place, that increasingly individualizes the relationship of exploitation, right? That increasingly hides also the relation of exploitation, because the ideology that accompanies that development is an ideology that mystifies the relationship of exploitation and portrays it as in fact, a relationship of self-investment, right? In the ideology, we are all little capitalists. So that the student who goes to the bank to apply for a loan to continue his or her studies, right, is now the little capitalist who says, oh, I will invest in myself so that I will have higher wages. And what is communicated, presumably, in that process is that we are the sole beneficiary of that investment. Right? By the fact that in front of us, right, that we are now related to the capitalist world, you know, through a loan, through a relationship from the bank rather than the employer, there is a displacement that begins to take place, where the fact that that loan is actually a way of organizing your work, is actually a way of exploiting you, is organizing your life as a student, but not only as a student, because it's organizing your life also as a worker while you're studying, but also after you have finished with your formal studies. Because then once you've taken these loans, in a way, you have a whole lifetime to repay them. And many, many decisions that you will have to make in your life after you end your schooling will be shaped by the fact of this loan that now becomes a yoke. It becomes a means of disciplining your labor. Again, not only as a student, so that you will not go to so many meetings, but actually you take three jobs to begin to pay off the loan, but also it becomes a way of organizing the labor of the future. What kind of job will you take? What kind of job you will not take so that you can pay the loan? In the United States, by the way, you can never get rid of that loan. It's the only type of loan for which you cannot become bankrupt. Right? You will die, and hopefully your parents will not have to sign with you. Because even if you die, we now have testimonies of parents whose children have died, and they are paying their student loans. Right? And we have people who are now in their quite advanced age, and they're still paying their student loans. Because I will turn to that too also, because there's all kinds of mechanisms that are inserted in that law to make sure that you have to be very, very strict in the repayment process. Otherwise, the loan will increase in ways that will be almost impossible to meet. So, again, what you begin to see is that the issue of debt is not only an issue of impoverishment on one side and accumulation on the other, but it's also an issue of transformation in the class relation. Transformation in the form that the class relation takes, right? Which is extremely mystifying. Mystifying, as I said, precisely because it hides the relation of exploitation. Because it mystifies as a relation of self-investment. It hides that the work that, for example, one does as a student is a work, and I'm using always this example because we're here in the university, it's also work that will benefit the entire employer's class. It's not only a work that benefits the, you know, your life, which is quite dull, but hopefully it will, but it's mostly work that will benefit those who will employ you in the future. Like all of this mystified, and it becomes a very powerful tool of social control. And I'm going to come back to this in the later part of my talk, because it has become very clear also in the process of a movement, the organization of a movement that belongs, has been how debilitating, you know, that individualization and mystification of the struggle and the work relation has been from the point of view of building a movement. Because people feel individually responsible, right? The sense of commonality and strength that comes, for example, from being part of a wage relation. The wage, after all, still represented a certain type of common. Right? It's very seriously undermined when you are in a one-to-one relationship to a bank. And when you've taken a loan, and you are the ones who have taken the loan, and if you fail to repay it, there's a sense that it's your own individual failure. Right? That is your own individual failure. You should not have taken the loan. You made a mistake. You should have taken much less, etc., etc. It becomes more difficult to relate to the loan and to your struggle, you know, from the point of view of you and being a worker that is being exploited. And it becomes more and more, it acquires a whole moral characteristics that, as we have seen, becomes a obstacle in the sense of building a movement. And where this integrating, destructive character of the debt relation becomes most obvious is not even in the student movement, the student loan situation, but it's in the situation that has developed in many different countries of the world around the question of microfinance and microcredit. And which is a situation that is extremely important for us to become acquainted with, not only because so much ideology has been built upon it, and we need to understand what this development has been, which has already created a lot of social disruption in many regions of the world, but also because microfinance and microcredit, in the same way as they are administered in many parts of Asia, Africa, is also coming now to Europe and to the United States. And I know there's already, the Grameen Bank is already in Glasgow, at least according to my more recent research. It's the Grameen Bank has come to 10 American cities, including New York, in this in Queens. For those of you who know a bit about New York, there is an area of New York which is mostly made populated by immigrants, and the Grameen Bank just recently opened some of its offices there. And typically, the first phase is one of great success, happy customers, beautiful interviews. People have lifted themselves out of poverty with a few hundred dollars. And this, of course, has been the hype from the beginning. From the late 70s, I think the first bank was in 1976, when Yunus Mohammed in Bangladesh had this great idea, presumably, that the problem with the poor and poverty in the world, by the way, this category poor, I like to put it in quotes because it's a category that completely naturalizes exploitation. There's no such thing as poor. The people have been impoverished. There's no such thing as poor. But that the poor, the problem with them is they don't have their little cash that will be enough to really lift them out of poverty. And it's part of all this neoliberal idea. The real money is the productive force in society. And poverty is absence of money, because even a small amount presumably can really make a difference in your life. So according to the publicity, Yunus began to give few little loans, $25, $50, to poor women. And with that little money, they were able to start a small business and in a short time become more prosperous. Now, at that time, it was one experiment in the late 70s, and many years have passed. You know, over that time to present, this has become a huge business, a very, very huge business, right? Grameen Bank was supposed to be the bank of the poor. And I think now there's a very voluminous record that demonstrate the fact that alleviating poverty, what microfinance has done, has been really to create a population of people, mostly women, who are so heavily indebted to their banks or NGOs that from which they've taken the loans, that all their life has been disrupted. And that not only they are now more poor and in more dire condition than they were originally before taking the loan, but that in fact their own social fabric, the social fabric of their life, their social support system have also been disrupted. Because actually the great innovation and the great invention that people like Yunus Mohammed and the many NGOs that have actually been the intermediaries between the banks, the foreign donors, and the women on the ground to which the money has been given. The great innovation has been to realize that social commons, social groups, social relation can constitute a sort of capital and can actually be put to use in a particular way to, for example, in this case, ensure repayment. So that, in fact, the loans have always been given to the group, and usually women's group. Why? Because women are seen as more easily controllable, as more easily also intimidated, and as more responsible for repayment. Because women are those in charge of the reproduction of their families and communities, and therefore have developed habits of responsibility that are less present with, among men. Consequently, the debt, the loan, is always given to the women's group, and every member of that group is made responsible for repayment. So that should one member default or waver in her commitment to repayment, you have the rest of the group, in a sense, functioning as police, right, and functioning as enforcer of the repayment, right? And there is now a growing literature. For a long time, much of the literature on microfinance was very positive, singing the glories of these programs. Right now, there is a growing literature which I encourage you to read. There is, for example, a very, very important book by Lamia Khalid on the Grameen Bank in Bangladesh. They really describe the kind of machine that has been constructed precisely to ensure repayment, and describe in great minute detail how this machine works, right, in terms of the forms of surveillance and the forms of intimidation that it puts into place. And similar reports have come out from Bolivia, from Egypt, and more recently I found material also from parts of Africa, like Eritrea, and particularly Niger. And what transpires is a very common picture. It's a very, very common picture of loans given to a population of women who are already living on the edge of disaster, if you want, in very, very poor condition. Why poor condition? Yeah, of course, that is never explored, but clearly those poor conditions are the results of international policies that have devastated their community through land expropriation, through unequal trade exchanges, and so forth. But they are also treated as they were a natural given. So the loan is given to them, and once the loan has been accepted, a whole set of events begin to unfold that appear to be quite common, although in different social international contexts. Very soon, women cannot repay their husband for sick, a goat, they may have a little goat or some animal dies, a child needs some medical test, and when you are in a situation where you really live always in a state of crisis, very soon it's become difficult to repay the money. And unfortunately, when that repayment is not coming, you begin to feel all the pressure that is being put over you. It's very interesting that over the years, and this is something common in different countries, the NGOs that have been involved into this process have begun to study also all the different cultural ways in which you can shame people into repayment. So that in fact internationally a kind of ethnography of shame has been produced in conjunction with the economy, political economy of microfinance, that basically tries to understand what are the specific cultural codes in different countries that can be used, right, to incentivize people, so that you would not want, for example, to lose face in front of your community. And the mechanisms are not necessarily the same. And so this is where ethnography you know, comes very, very useful. And when a ethnography of shame is not sufficient, then what you have is more muscular ways, which is, you know, you have a cohort of people who may go to the village and begins to break down the door of the houses of the women who are not paid back and appropriate whatever they have. Cases in Bangladesh, for example, women's cooking, rice cooking pots have been taken away when they could not repay, which is something presumably that is the ultimate shame that a woman can face, because it's the ultimate humiliation not to be able to feed your family, and in many cases, in fact, husbands have left. Often the pictures of the women are also put on the wall of the banks, on the wall of the NGO offices from which the loan was taken. So that, again, the idea of the public shaming. And here is again the idea, right, of turning the common against itself. Of basically the idea of not only basically exploiting, squeezing the energy, the labor, whatever resources, you know, women who are already impoverished can still produce, and but also the idea of using this mechanism of the loan and the debt to, in fact, you know, destroy the kind of common, the kind of social bonding that ties many, many people in these communities, right? So that whereas you had a support system, the support system becomes the very people you begin to fear, the people you begin to be afraid of meeting because you are ashamed, and because they may be actually actively angry with you because of the fact that you are not making a repayment and they will be responsible for it. Right? So this is a very, very important, I think it's a very important lesson to see. Obviously, there's been a struggle against it. The struggle has been taking place in many parts of the world, you know, most strongly in Bolivia. In the early part, around 2002, hundreds and thousands of women went in the summer of that year to the La Paz and basically laid siege for a month to one of the banks that had the majority of the loans. To basically say we will not be able to pay. They're very, very powerful pictures of these women who, in a country and in a region that is fairly puritanical from the point of view of sexual mold, women basically walk to the bank, stripping themselves to demonstrate that everything has been taken away from their life and nothing has been left to them. Right? Now, this is important again to know, precisely because, as we say, I was saying before, these institutions now are also coming to our countries, and it's important to imagine, foresee what is ahead of many of the people who might take this loan. And it should be added that the interest rate for the loans that are taken are extremely high, you know, ranging from 20 to 30%. And you ask yourself, these are always described, the beneficiary, as the poorest of the poor, the poorest of the world. Why should the interest rate on loans that sometimes are not higher than $500 or $300, $400, why should the interest rate be so high? And the way they're justified is that in precisely because these people are the poorest of the poor, you have to do a lot of work, a lot of intensive labor work, leg work, to go and find out what is that they have that you can take, right? What is that they have in the shacks where they live, in the houses where they live, in the community, that can be appropriated, should they, again, not be able to pay back their loan. And in fact, as a result of this situation, In many, many cases, you have women now who have developed 2 or 3 loans, who continuously have to buy, get new loans to repay the old ones because they are continuously falling behind. So that whereas the Grameen Bank of the world was supposed to take care of the money lenders, who were the traditional bloodsuckers of the poor, particularly in rural areas, now the money lenders have a feast, and in fact many apparently are opening their offices next to the NGOs, the offices of the NGO, next to the offices of the banks, because they know that they women will need to get new loans to pay back those they have received, and they will be terrified not to do so, because if they do not so, they will face a kind of public shame that they feel will ruin their life. In fact, often they have been, women have not paid back, have been attacked by the others in the group, left them being abandoned by their husband. In fact, according to Vandana Shiva, that you probably, I'm sure you know her work, many of the farmers in India, the 15,000 farmers who in recent years have killed themselves. Many of them were men who had co-signed with their wives. They had co-signed the loan that the women had taken from this bank. Okay, now, so again, we see that the debt, right, represents something more than an economic means, and that an economic tool, that a way of squeezing money from different sectors of the population, right? But the debt represents a whole way of structuring social relations, right? It's very important. So when we think, we need to think of wages, we need to think of debt, we need to think them not only as ways of, again, accumulation of money in a sort of self-enclosed way, but we need to also think of them as way of producing or disaccumulating community. Right? Producing or disaccumulating community. And clearly what the debt is, it's also a way of undermining all those forms of relationship that tie people in a way that produces a common interest, right? And in a sense, individualizes the form of exploitation. As I said, mystifies it, hides it, but above all, atomizes it, individualizes it, right? And puts a very strong moralistic clock over it. So the question is, working myself towards a conclusion, the question is, what are the alternatives here? Right? What kind of struggles, particularly trying to think of the principle that I laid, that I developed at the beginning of my talk, how do we think, create struggles that not only put an end to the debt that exists, but also, most important, put an end to the condition that create indebtedness? Because what is the point of not paying the debt if tomorrow you get in debt again? If you don't change the social relationship by which the debt is produced. So there are two very different conceptions of how do you fight against debt. And one demands that we actually think of really changing the society and the structures and the social relation that produces the debt, right? And here, I think that when we look at the way the debt is functioning, and in particular, the importance that in the debt machine, the destruction of common relations, the destruction of social bonding, occupies, right? You see, in fact, you have, from that importance, you begin to get a clue as to how we may begin to organize, in a way that goes beyond the denial of payment, the refusal to pay, right? And so what I want to close is to basically propose, and not only as a sort of a utopia, but as something that is already happening in many parts of the world, and that the alternative to the debt is certainly not the return to a type of welfare state, right? Welfare in quote. And why not? First of all, it's not because we are in a moment in which capitalism is making it very, very clear to us that they have nothing to give us. That they do not intend to give us anything. It was very interesting to watch the electoral campaign in the United States this year. Campaigns, I won't even go and comment on what the electoral campaigns are about and the sort of the fraudulent ways in which what the whole process is about. But it was very interesting to see, right, that the level that you had a whole set of politicians that campaign on the basis of give all to that stage, and we don't have to promise anything. All that we promise that we'll cut your pension, we'll cut your medical care, we'll cut every spending that now goes to social benefit. And this very much is the kind of proposal that now is coming in reality from so many parts of the power structure that in fact, the state is not responsible in any way, for our reproduction. Mm-hmm. And that the state possesses now mechanisms of permanent accumulation. For example, through the movement of capital across the world that allows processes of very quick investment and disinvestment in jobs and forms of production, so that we have this mechanism of permanent accumulation that makes it very possible for the state, in fact, to dismantle what the benefits that we may have been able to extract from them. And in closing, I want to propose, and then we can elaborate more concretely in the discussion period, that the only alternative that we can construct, in this situation, in this situation where we have these two possibilities of a relationship to reproduction and a relationship to capitalism. On one side, what used to be called the welfare state, where in a sense is the state that invests, that has resources that have taken from us and invest in certain aspects so that we can be more productive. And on the other, this market that places us as little capitalists, as little investors in ourselves, and puts us in a condition which is even worse than in the relationship to the welfare state, because it is a condition in which we confront capital in a way that is even more individualized and therefore disempowered. And what is the alternative? And I would say that the alternative is, in fact, the construction, right, of more autonomous forms of reproduction. The construction of what many people now call reproductive commons, of which we begin to see some of the first elements Even in our own countries, even, for example, in the States and different parts of Europe, the construction of collective structures of reproduction, whether it is the communal garden, whether it is the time banks, whether it is the different forms of solidarity economies, which now appear as reaffirmed and clearly have to be imagined in a different way. They have to imagine a way that begins to coordinate them, that begins to think of them together, that begins to think in a way that they can provide a sort of counterpower, that they can provide forms of autonomy from the state, not to replace the state, and not to let the state off the hook, not to let the state in possession of the wealth they've taken from us, but to actually build a base, a social base, from which to confront the state and to begin that process of reclamation, forced reparation, and all that redistribution that we need to have in order to reclaim our life, not only the wealth that's been taken with us, but it's our future, our life. I will stop here, and I will look forward to your questions. Thank you.